Good morning. Driving impaired may be code for driving drunk. Driving experts also include texting and especially driving drowsy. We'll talk with a visiting sleep expert who's in Hawaii this week for a statewide schools campaign to make the point. Also this week, a group of ocean conservationists from 15 countries is in Honolulu. They're hoping to create a strategy for science to counter the political, social, and economic impulses that often frustrate ocean management, or should we say people management. We'll get a status report. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Ramblin' Steve Gardner's a blues troubadour, and there aren't that many of them around. And historian and playwright Jacqueline Puolani Johnson listens in on a visit with Emma and Lulio Kalani.
It's Wednesday, February 10th. The conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation for a Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Both of us drive to work in the very early morning. And
in the dark.
In the dark. And we might find ourselves wondering if our fellow motorists are entirely awake.
Often that is the case, especially when you're watching someone from behind and you see how they're driving a little bit. Not necessarily in the middle of the road. But then again, during the daylight hours, that can happen too when someone is driving and you can clearly see that something is wrong. What's wrong could be something that you don't think about a whole lot, but we're going to talk about it this morning. Now, if you've been driving for a while, you've probably had some experience that's made you understand viscerally how quickly something can go wrong when you're behind the wheel. For young people, well, maybe not so much, unless they've been in a car with adults who are texting or speeding or driving drowsy. This week, 35 schools statewide are promoting the Stop If You Love Me campaign. It's a partnership between Dietrich Insurance and the State Department of Education. Dr. Matthew Yules is a sleep medicine expert in Hawaii this week to speak about driving drowsy, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Beth Ann, for having us on this morning.
This is something that we don't usually talk a whole lot about. We're a sleep-deprived nation anyway. We know that people don't get nearly the amount of sleep that they should, so why would anybody want to talk about being sleepy and behind the wheel? Why, indeed, is the subject of part of what's happening with this year, with this week's campaign in our schools. So let's talk a little bit about how dangerous this really is. Can you give me some comparative value between driving drunk and driving drowsy?
Yes. So they've actually have conducted some studies where they've taken a group of people and intentionally sleep deprived them, let them rest up, catch up on their sleep, and then they've given them alcohol and compared their ability to drive, their ability, reaction time, thought processes, and things drunk versus just sleepy. And when we analyzed the results, we were really, really surprised to find out that whether you're intoxicated or whether you're sleep-deprived, the same impairments. It affects judgment, it affects reaction time, coordination, to the same level of actually being intoxicated. So the breakdown is 19 hours without sleep and you function a blood alcohol level of 0.08, legally intoxicated in all 50 states.
That's stunning. And yet we seem not even to talk about that in the same level of driving literally drunk.
Yeah, so I've been invited to come here with a group called Tired. It's an organization founded by a mother who lost her teenage son, 18 years old, fell asleep on a bright sunny afternoon driving home. She was a good mother. She had spoken with her son, talked to him about all the important things driving, you know, wear your seatbelt, don't text and drive, don't drink and drive. Only two guys could be in the car at a time. And so she laid down the law. The one thing she didn't talk to him about was drowsy driving because she wasn't aware. And she knew he was only averaging about 5 hours of sleep. But as a mom, you pick your battles, right? And this was a battle that she didn't know was an important one. And unfortunately, it cost him his life. And at this point in time, we're on a mission to make sure other people are educated about not only the dangers of drowsy driving, that it's you're more likely to die in a drowsy driving crash than texting and driving and drunk driving combined, but really the importance of sleep. Sleep has a lot of value and a purpose and function for us.
You know that because you study it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, we don't seem to value sleep. We look at sleep as being something that, well, you don't really need that. And you're wimpy if you need too much sleep. And, of course, you should be there and you know, pushing yourself to the limit. We watch kids stay up until 11 o'clock, midnight, doing their homework because they have homework they have to complete. They have all kinds of other activities in the afternoons. And they're not getting a whole lot of sleep, particularly the time of life when they should be getting the most sleep. How do you make the case to parents who say, well, my kid's got to compete. I've got to compete.
Yeah, so as adults, we're doing a really poor job modeling the importance of sleep. Each generation, we get less and less sleep. Before Edison invented the light bulb, we estimate the average American slept about 10 hours a night. We're down to about 6.8. The high school age kids aren't much better. They're getting 6.9 hours of sleep, and they really need about 9 to 10 hours. So they're sleep deprived an hour or two each and every night, and it does come as a price and a consequence. And you're exactly right. Our society, we believe we need to work harder and longer, and if you're falling behind, you just keep digging it out until you're successful, right? But there's a rate of limit in terms of the harder and harder you work doesn't produce an equal effect, and sometimes it's actually better to catch up on your rest and be more effective and efficient at your approach to things versus just working longer. And you know, we've been going into different high schools and different organizations and businesses and talking to them about not only the drowsy driving but the importance of sleep. And, you know, we get some feedback, and sometimes we're able to convince a teen the importance of sleep, and they go home and they talk to their parents, and their parents say, you're lazy, get up and do your homework, and, you know, go get a job, and you know, they actually are sending the wrong message to their own children.
And then you have people who are in our business who have to function in a 24-hour news cycle. In times, there are ways you just can't get out of having to be up at certain hours and not having that full sleep. In the darkness, in normal hours of sleep where the body regulates itself, is there any way around any of that for a lot of, you know, kids who are going to be staying up late, regardless of everything you've just said, and for a lot of us who have to get up at oh dark 30 anyway?
Yeah, so our body does have a clock that tells us when to eat and when to sleep. And, you know, a couple of things about that clock. It tells us to be sleepy between 4 and 6 o'clock in the morning. More people are involved in drowsy driving accidents during that time, even though they're the fewest number of cars on the road. The second thing about that is there's a secondary peak of drowsiness in the afternoon between 2 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon when people get sleepy. And oftentimes, because we think the sun is out and it's a bright afternoon, we're not going to fall asleep. But biologically, we're actually sleepy and tired during that time. When we talk about teens, their clock is actually shifted. They have what's called delayed sleep phase syndrome, in which they go to bed later. The average teen wants to go to bed about 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And for them to go to bed at 9, 10 o'clock would be for like an adult to try to go to sleep at 6 o'clock. And that can be difficult. Now, it's not impossible to adjust to. So if, like yourself, you're getting up early during that 4 or 6 o'clock in the morning time, or for our teens to go to bed earlier, there's some simple things we can do to adjust the clock. The first thing is to keep a consistent schedule. Go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time.
Even on
the
weekends.
Week and as well on the weekends. And then light really affects our clock. Getting bright sunlight first thing in the morning will help advance your clock, make it easier to fall asleep at night. Avoiding light at night prevents your clock from being delayed. And
including on these little gadgets.
Exactly where I was headed with that. Yeah, we found out that our eyes are very sensitive to a particular wavelength of color. And our iPhones, our smartphones, computers, tablets are extremely bright in that wavelength.
TVs too?
I'm sorry?
TVs too?
TVs, the flat screen TVs, not the traditional ones. And fortunately, some of the companies have recognized this. So there's some programs you can download for your Android phone. And Apple has just finally recognized it. The newest version of software coming out in the next week or two will have a program built into the operating system called Night Shift, which after hours when the sun sets, that blue-green wavelength will disappear and you're still able to use your phone, but it won't delay your sleep.
That's good news for a lot of us. I wish we had much more time to talk, but Dr. Eales, thank you so much for being here. A pleasure.
Oh, pleasure.
Sleep medicine educator Dr. Matthew Yules is the Vice President of Diagnostics, Research, and Technology at the Clayton Sleep Institute. He lectures and leads courses at St. Louis University and Forest Park College, as well as at regional and national sleep conferences. He's been a principal investigator or co-investigator in sleep research trials to counter insomnia, pain, and stress. This week, he's in Honolulu to help with the Stop If You Love Me campaign.
From New Hampshire to old business, a crucial primary becomes so last Tuesday. We do the math of the New Hampshire aftermath and sort out the noise from the relevant momentum, how the South Carolina and Nevada contests answer questions left hanging by New Hampshire voters, a look at who gets the boost and the boot from New Hampshire. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
And this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:16, and coming up in a minute, a world-traveling blues artist. But first, your quiz.
Yesterday, we had a conversation about the upcoming Waimea Town Days celebration on Kauai. And for today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the names that you might have heard. This was the last independent ruler of Kauai, the Ali'inui of Kauai and Niihau, who ruled as king in those islands from 1794 to 1810. He was the last holdout against the island-by-island conquest of Kamehameha I, who made two failed attempts to conquer Kauai before finally forcing its ruler to cede control in 1810. Kamehameha had raised a huge armada equipped with foreign-made cannon for his third attempt, and the ruler settled into a diplomatic solution to avoid a massacre. Kauai's last king became a vassal of Kamehameha, serving as governor of the island until his death in 1824. This morning, we're wondering if you remember his name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the t-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Blues artists have a sense of mission because the music carries a message, and it's about a lot more than hard times and hard feelings. It's about overcoming those barriers and carrying on. It's a message Steve Gardner and his resonator guitar have taken all over the world, and that's why they call him Ramblin' Steve. He's from Mississippi, and those influences will never leave him. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Chris.
Thanks Ramblin' Steve, I should say.
Thanks so much
for
having me here.
By his proper name, right?
That's right. That's right.
You know, one of the things that I hear about the blues that always riles me is the whole notion that it's sad or depressing.
Right.
It's kind of to the opposite, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. If you're alive and you're feeling anything, you're going to have the whole gamut. And that's what the blues is.
Well, so much of blues is about I'm overcoming those feelings in one way or another. The sun's going to shine in my back door, that kind
right.
of thing. I like that spirit a lot.
That's exactly where I come from. I don't like to play blame songs. I want to take.
Go.
I want to. It's my fault. It's my fault.
That's a good category. You'll be sorry that you left me. Oh, boo-hoo, right? Yeah.
Yes, they send you a letter saying it's the best thing I've ever done.
Blame songs. I'm going to remember that.
So I try not to do that. But you're exactly right, Chris. I think that's what the blues is. Celebration of being alive.
Yeah. Well, how did you get started with it?
Well, I'm from Mississippi and grew up around the music. My dad and uncle used to play in a little string band. My dad played kitchen knives. I grew up, you know, beating bones together and whatnot, and he played kitchen knives. My uncle beat on the guitar, and I always wanted to be a part of that. I thought, man, there's nothing better than making music and making people happy.
And I'm sure the diddly bow figured into that equation at some point, right?
Well, it did. Not so much for me. I had a cigar box guitar growing up,
okay.
Made from rubber bands and sort of all together. All the kids had something like that. But being a lefty made it sort of hard for me. I never could figure out that right-handed thing.
Yeah. And well, you flip the guitar over and flip the string, so the bass string is closest to you.
Right. It looks like a guitar in the mirror if you're a right-handed
person,
pretty much.
Strange things.
Play it on the show, people look at you like you're kind of crazy.
But we've got to talk a little bit about your acts, because
this is the
traveling country blues man's acts of choice, and it's made of steel, right?
It is. It's a National Resophonic style low guitar. It's not so different from the guitar that was made in about 1928 or 29, I guess, by the National Company.
Yeah.
And it's made of the body. This particular body is made of brass. And it's covered in nickel. And the whole point of the thing is that it's a mechanical amplifier, really.
Right.
It's a guitar with a mechanical amplifier instead of an electronic one. That's the whole, I'll just hit a little bit, you know, so we can get a thing. So it's a pretty loud guitar.
Super loud, yeah.
And the idea is that it would be something that could be heard through the noise of dancers, and to be perfectly honest, it wasn't made for blues in the beginning, right?
Right,
it was
right,
made for jazz players and to beat the horns, you know. So it's got a little bit of a horn sound in there if you grab up to it.
Yeah, and the resonator chamber resembles the shape of a speaker, right?
So it does.
It's a little bowl for the sound to. The sound waves hit, and then they get shot right back out.
That's it. It's in a little aluminum plate and makes a lot of noise. Yeah. It's a fabulous instrument. I'm so proud to have it. But it's like carrying a four-year-old child around with you all the time. It weighs about that much.
An overweight four-year-old child. Well, speaking of making noise, Steve, let's have you do it.
Well, you guys were so kind to play a cut off my Hesitation Blues record, so let me play you a tune I wrote. It's called Mississippi River Blues, and just a little up tempo for the morning. Hope you guys like it.
You know it sure be wide. Yes, my gal on the other side, she's gone. Yes, she packed up and gone. Big boat up the river, turning on a bank of sand. Reckon don't strike water, Lord, it ain't gonna land. She's gone. Well, she packed up and gone.
Just a little taste of that.
Yeah, you really got that. I was going to say right hand, but in your case, left hand. Finger picking thing down, right? You bounce on those bass strings and keep a kind of counter melody going at the same time.
Well, I appreciate that. I know you're a guitar strangler yourself, and I really appreciate those kind words.
Well, you strangled that one for sure.
Well, I play sort of out of self-defense, to be honest. I mean, being for the most part, a solo player, you try and offer up a full band or you're battling the piano, really. I mean, the old guys are trying to find a piano. And so that's a little bit about what I try and do.
But, you know, it just has so much power and projection. And, of course, when your instrument is pumping out that kind of power, you've got to match it with your voice.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Which you do.
Well, the old guys I used to play with, you know, we were talking about Fred McDowell earlier. I did not meet Mr. Fred, but
the great
I knew
Mississippi Fred. Yeah.
Knew Jessie Mae Hempel. I heard her granddaddy was Sid, and Fred was from up in that hill country area.
Right.
And Jack Owens and Mr. Sam Chapman, and you'd sit around with them. And the one thing that was so nice that they said, one was, yes, it's your voice, and your guitar is your second voice.
Right.
And then the other thing that gave me an awful lot of power and encouragement as a young fellow was they said, you know, Steve, you're not me and I'm not you, so you better find your own way into this music. And, you know, I'll be honest, I'm kind of a guitar holder. I couldn't copy somebody. I can't copy my own self. So it gave me a lot of freedom to just get out there and try my best at cheering people up, if I could.
You know, one of the great things about when the blues artists that you and I met as younger men, as mentors, was that they always would say something like that.
Yeah.
Go be yourself. And always really welcome you into that world, don't you? Didn't you feel that way?
I have always felt that. They were very confident, and as a younger guy, they were good enough, as you say, to welcome me in. Sometimes they'd tell you to sit down.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to sit down and listen, but otherwise
it's a priceless education, Steve. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you all so much for having me. And
great
having
to have you.
Have a great, happy 2016.
We will. Steve Gardner will perform this Friday at Anna O'Brien's in Honolulu, and Sunday at the studio at Hawaiian Brian's in Honolulu. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
HPR selects and purchases programs from National Public Radio, American Public Media, and so many other content providers. Our station members have followed the money trail and realized that it starts and ends with them. Our thanks to these enlightened individuals, Eden Hifo of Kailua, Jennifer Bennett of Kapolei, and Edmund and Cheryl Kito of Mililani. So, how about adding your name to that list? You can call us during business hours at 955-8821 to find out about sustaining your public radio station. And thanks. Good government bills had a tough time getting off the ground last session. This time around may yield more positive results, as we've heard in recent weeks from the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, and Civil Beat Law Center. Today, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has an update. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Taking a look first at one of the big pushes from last year was changing the way we might be voting.
Right, and it's up again. It didn't get through last year, but the idea is to have our elections here exclusively by mail. In fact, when you sign up for a driver's license, you would automatically be registered to vote, although you can opt out. So that's one of the big things that people are pushing. As you know, it can be a bit of a pain to go to the voting booth, stand in line, and so forth. And the idea is, you know, why not just take the ballot and discuss the various options to vote around the kitchen table with your family and friends? So we'll see if that gains traction.
Well, some of the other bills that we've been looking at also look at how we might be not just voting, but how we could not have to have the Social Security number attached to that, too.
Right. That's another thing, a privacy concern. Why should that number be put in voter information? Now, all these bills, the intention is to do two things, really. One is to boost voter turnout. As you know, we're not very good when it comes to voter turnout here in the state. But we also want to try and influence, or rather lessen the influence of money in politics. And so there's a couple of bills. One of them requires lobbyists to have a higher standard of conduct when it comes to disclosures. There's another one that increases fines for campaign donation disclosure and so forth. And as you mentioned, Common Cause and the League of Women Voters, but also State Ethics Commission, the Campaign Spending Commission, the Elections Office are behind these efforts as well.
Of all the 11 bills that are looking at the Campaign Spending Commission and all the things that, that are tangentially related to that, too, some of which you've just mentioned, is there one that you think has a better chance this year than perhaps in other years when we've discussed some of these very same issues?
You know, it's so early. It's only the first part of February. We've got till the beginning of May for the session to end, and I'm always afraid to offer a prediction. I will caution, however, there are other bills that would seem to be the opposite of good government. For example, there's a bill to weaken the ethics code. There's another one that would exempt certain groups from financial disclosures. I'm thinking of the border regions. There's even another one that would loosen the laws on posting meeting notices for government get-togethers. So you can see there's always, you know, like Nathan Eagle says in his story today, last year some of these bills made it, some of them didn't. But there seems to be a more concerted effort this time around. I think people have politics in mind, given that it's an election year.
And hopefully it won't be a case of what you gain on the turns, you lose on the roundabouts. Thanks,
exactly.
Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Nohea Gallery at Ward Warehouse, with gift ideas for Valentine's Day from Hawaii's artists, including handcrafted jewelry, jewelry boxes of local woods, and paintings and prints for home and office. NoheaGallery.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, I always love to hear about these robotics competitions.
Well, you know, I've heard people tell us that they love to hear about robotics. They also tell us that they love to hear students. And we, the last time we had the VEX people on, we were covering a high school championship competition. And this past weekend, there was a competition for VEX IQ, which involved elementary and middle school students. So we've got the sixth graders coming in, and it'll be a fun conversation because when I was watching their VEX IQ competition, which still involves robots, and I thought maybe these robots would be a little bit more basic and simpler, but I don't think so. You know, these guys were very – the robots were complex. The designs were complex. The tasks that they had to do was not trivial.
Yeah.
And – these guys really perform, so I'm just loving to hear what they have to say.
Well, for one thing, in those competitions, Bert, they get assigned pretty difficult tasks for a robot to do. It's not just walk around and walk back, right?
Yeah. These robots had to shoot a bunch of balls into a container, but you know, just the design that some of these bots took really showed that the students put a lot of thought into how they designed them, and there were the whole range of, you know, robots that were flimsily made and some that were like tanks. So it was great, and you know, we got a couple of teams from Mililani coming on, and we want to talk a little bit about them and how they both decided to form their respective teams.
Well, it has a lot to do with the things that bright kids can do when they're given a chance, right?
That's true, and it, of course, involves a lot of dedication by mentors and teachers that are involved with, you know, taking time out of their daily teaching schedule and mentoring these kids to, you know, to reach these high levels. So it's exciting, and I love to see these guys progress.
Well, it sounds like a fun show, Bert. We'll look for that tonight, and that's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a spring open house where parents can learn more about the school's educational experience, Sunday, February 21st at 2:30, sacredhearts.org.
The science of marine conservation is often at odds with political, social, and economic pressures. Over the past few days, a group of 125 participants from 18 universities in 15 countries have been gathering in Honolulu. Their goal is to create a comprehensive strategy for countering the human challenges of large-scale marine protected areas. One of the think tank organizers is Alan Friedlander. He's chief scientist of the National Geographic Pristine Seas Program and the director of the UH Fisheries Ecology Research Lab. Before he heads off to the last day of the conference, he's in our studio with a progress report. Good morning, Alan. Thank you for being here.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
It's a tough thing when you look at the world's oceans and see so little of them protected compared to the amount of land that we protect. What's the ratio?
On land, it's more like 10 to 15%, and really we're talking about less than 2% of the ocean being really substantially protected from, you know, human interactions.
What seems to frustrate that part of it the most when you're trying to protect the oceans? And we think we hear a lot about ocean conservation, particularly in Hawaii, but then hearing you say something that stunning, what's the biggest problem?
Public awareness for a lot of things are just, you know, we're disconnected from the ocean. We shouldn't be so in Hawaii. Most of Hawaii is water. We need it for food security, recreation, commerce. It creates half the oxygen on the planet. You know, we really rely on the ocean, yet overfishing, climate change, land-based pollution, shoreline development, it's death by a thousand cuts. So we don't really see it directly, but the ocean's being impacted and we need it so much. But yet people have a hard time rationalizing. But we're trying to go back to what people really worked on in the past, which was local management of resources, and then trying to expand that out to a large global scale to have meaningful conservation.
What I hear you say, though, is that there may be a thousand cuts, but they all come down to human activity.
That's right. I mean, the oceans take very good care of themselves without us. What we really need to manage is people, and that's the point of this workshop. It's pretty inspiring. We have people from throughout the Pacific, French Polynesia, New Caledonia, Cook Islands, Palau, and all these people have a history of long marine conservation, but now we're trying to bring it into the 21st century in large-scale conservation. So having all these people together is incredibly inspiring, and trading ideas, knowledge exchanges, and we're kind of all learning from each other because the concept of large-scale marine protection is relatively new. Other than the Great Barrier Reef, Papanaumokuakea was originally created in 2000, and it's one of the older ones. So a lot of these places are just coming online now, so it's a real whole gradient of from places just being designated to places that have been designated for 15 years. So we're all learning from each other's experiences.
15 years is not a very long time, as you mentioned, especially with so little of the ocean being protected. As you have been working this week, so far at least, what do you find as being some of the common elements that have been emerging, especially for areas that we may not even realize are more threatened than others?
One of the main things is engaging people from the very beginning of the process. People are the problem, but they're also the solution. And so local community efforts are bubbling up all over the place, including Hawaii, and they really need to be nurtured. But it's an issue of scale. There's there's external powers coming into play, deep sea ocean mining, large scale commercial fishing, all these things impinge on the ocean, and they all affect people in different ways. And so trying to figure out what's the right match to have people respond to these issues, because people are ultimately going to be the solution to this problem as well.
Are you looking at this as any sort of, you know, run-up to the World Conservation Congress later on this year?
Exactly. This is a really good venue for that. Hawaii's been a leader in large-scale marine conservation with the creation of Papanaumokuakea, and the fact that the World Conservation Congress is going to be in Hawaii in September. President Obama will be here, lots of heads of state, important decision makers, and it's really the premier venue for moving the United Nations and the world forward in conservation in general, but we really want to emphasize marine conservation and ocean conservation because it's in Hawaii. I'm part of the International Union for Conservation for Nature Task Force on large-scale marine protected areas, and we'll be presenting the findings from this workshop at the World Conservation Congress, so we're pretty excited about having that public forum and highlighting Hawaii's progress in this compared to other places around the world.
Talking about other places around the world, are there places that we don't really think about as being particularly challenged that we should know more about, particularly as we are in Hawaii?
Such as?
Well, I was thinking, you know, Cook Islands, other places where we don't really talk a lot about, even though we're in Hawaii and we think that we are reasonably plugged into the fact that we're an island community, and yet other island communities, and we talk about what's been happening in, you know, Micronesia, but how do we bring that into a greater and more, you know, sort of comprehensive strategy that networks all of these people that you are dealing with this week?
Right. So there's something called the Big Ocean. It's a network of large-scale marine protected areas, users, practitioners, managers. It's approximately 15 organizations now, but it's growing quickly. And it's a learning exchange, and we don't know a lot about a lot of these places, but the Pacific's connected. All these islands and all the people in the Pacific are connected by the ocean. And long before European contact, there was voyaging alliances that took place. Raiatea in the Society Islands was an important hub where people would meet in the past, and Hawaii's tending to be that now with the Polynesian Voyaging Society and so forth. And, you know, therefore, this workshop is kind of a reinvention of past practices where there's knowledge exchanges, agreements. So we're all learning from each other. The Pacific's huge. You know, it's half the planet almost. And so all these different countries have different goals and aspirations, but there's the common theme of they're small islands but large ocean countries. And so they all have that need to have healthy oceans.
The irony of having to look back to the old ways in a time of great technology certainly isn't being lost on anyone who's attending the conference this week. But are there things that have, even over the couple of days that you've been meeting, emerged that you think we should think more about as we move toward the end of the year and the Congress meeting here, World Congress meeting here?
Sure. So there's all the past ills that we've put on the ocean, but there's all these new things coming online. Deep sea mining, which is technologically feasible and economically viable now. Large-scale industrial fisheries can have huge impacts in places that can directly affect the livelihoods, the well-being, and the culture of people in those places. So there's internal factors and there are external factors all pushing on the ocean, and people need to take more of a holistic view of how to move forward. So some of these things aren't even online yet. We don't know what is going to happen in the future. So it's always good to have a precautionary approach because we only have one planet, and it's easier to conserve stuff than to fix it after you've broken it.
Precautionary principles tends to fall on deaf ears sometimes. Is there a way that you think that, having said what we just heard you say, that, you know, there's only one planet, there's only one ocean system, that we might be able to buy into that precautionary principle a little bit better than perhaps we have in other areas of science?
I think so. I mean, Hawaii in particular, you know, we all interact with the ocean almost on a daily basis. So people, you know, see what's good and bad about the ocean, and we rely on it very heavily. And so I think we can be an inspiration for other places. But throughout, you know, most of the people at this conference are in the same boat or, you know, in the same
Literally.
Body of water, right? And so we all, you know, we all rely on it. I think these people appreciate it. And so they're all really good spokespeople for people who may not have the same interaction or association with the ocean. It's, like I said at the very beginning, you know, as the ocean goes, we go. And so it's really incumbent upon us to take care of it if we want to be healthy society, healthy planet.
On that note, we're going to leave it. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Alan Friedlander is the chief scientist of the National Geographic Pristine Seas Program, also the director of the Fisheries Ecology Research Lab at the UH. Over 30 years, he's focused on population regulation in marine ecosystems, most recently to help us understand what the ocean was like before heavy human impact.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about the last independent ruler of Kauai, Aniihau, who managed to hold on to his island kingdom for years after Kamehameha I had subdued the rest of the islands. When he was still a teenager, he met and befriended Captain George Vancouver,
who encouraged him to learn English. He was seen as a diligent student of both European customs and those of his own people. He was renowned as a young man for his ability to memorize lengthy genealogical chants, and his English skills helped him deal with the foreign sandalwood traders who came to Hawaii in the early 19th century. In 1810, Kamehameha I raised the largest armada the islands had ever seen for his third and final attempt to conquer Kauai, and King Kaumualii elected to negotiate a settlement rather than do battle. He went on to serve as the island's governor until his death in 1824.
And we had a shy caller who knew that answer and phoned us. We'll get the T-shirt anyway. Thanks so much for playing with us on the Backyard Quiz. And if you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Every student of history wonders at some point what historical figures might have said to one another when no one else was around. And recreating such conversations can be tricky for the author of historical fiction. You want to be true to the personalities of the people involved and to the historical record. Jackie Pualani Johnson is a UH Hilo professor of theater and the author of Na Wahine Ali'i, A Visit with Emma and Liliuo Kalani, two short plays that will be performed this weekend on Kauai. And she's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Jackie.
Aloha kakahiaka.
Very intriguing idea you had for this.
And it's reached out to audiences here on the Big Island already and made a difference in our understanding of the humans behind all of the history and the government and the politics.
And that's always a
wonderful opening.
That's a task for the historian, isn't it?
It is very true. We're very fortunate that some of the ali'i actually have a lot of thoughts that were put to the page, especially Liliuo Kalani, because she wrote up her own remembrances and feelings about what was happening to her at the time that Hawaii was in such turmoil. We have a wonderful resource there, but that's not de rigueur for the other monarchs. So writing the script about Queen Emma, for instance, took a matter of finding every source that said anything about her at all and trying to pull the person from those resources.
That's where you can only extrapolate from what you've got, right?
That's very true. Interestingly enough, though, you know, there are sources out there. I mean, everything from information about the different diseases that went through Hawaii, you know, those kinds of facts.
Sure.
Other people remarking about associations with the monarchy, et cetera. And, of course, Liliu's words. But the wonderful thing about the Liliu script that really focuses on her private life is that her descendants now on Oahu were given a chance to look at it and to make commentary about the material that was there. So that was a treasure to have the family say, consider this as a possibility.
I assume that was extremely helpful.
Oh, my goodness. And it's kind of controversial, too, because usually when you're working with history, something has to be somewhere in the written word for it to be fact. That's what most people say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily the Hawaiian way. So I did choose to use the information from the family that is not necessarily written down here and there, but I feel it has more of a connection and validity because it is their family history.
Well, I think you have to approach it that way when dealing with Hawaiian family histories, don't you?
I agree. And oral history, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you can't impose Western European traditions on everything.
Exactly.
Even though many have tried, right?
Uh-huh. That's so true. So this, because it echoed through generations and it was the truth as the family knew it, made a difference in one portion of the script. And the script is called Liliuo Kalani at Washington Place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as though the audience is sitting there, you know, politely sitting in that lovely Victorian setting, listening to the Queen reminisce. And those moments that talk about her and her Hanai children are the focus of the script itself. So very personal.
So, yeah, it's more so than her reaction to the historical currents.
That's right. Little things rear their head here and there. You know, there are things that you cannot ignore because she was challenged late in her life about her competency. She begins by saying that, you know, when she was dethroned. So none of that's avoided. But the focus is totally on Liliuo Kalani as a woman and a mother.
both Emma and Ludigo evoked a lot of personal warmth from the people around them. Is that fair to say?
Greatly loved. I agree with that, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that also had effect on politics as well, because Emma had to jostle through that political situation herself once her husband passed and she was dealing with her own status in Hawaii. And that became a problem and a struggle for her and Liliuokalani, and that's gently referred to in the scripts. They do not encounter each other in these two pieces, but there's a logical connection from Emma's life, and that script is called Vespers at Hanaya Kamalama.
Uh-huh.
It takes place on the porch of the summer palace. And then she concludes with her death and what it was like to be laid to rest. And then Liliuokalani picks up with her own story, her own being Hanai at an early age and eventually choosing to Hanai children herself.
So what's the historical period of the Queen Emma portion?
Well, it actually reflects on when she was actually born and takes her through life. And she and Liliu were contemporaries. Liliu lives much further.
Yeah.
So there's an overlap there in time. So we're talking about the mid-1800s to Liliu passed away in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
So we do span quite a bit of Hawaiian history in a very volatile, dynamic time of growth and tragedy. And, you know, their personal tragedies come to the fore in these scripts because they had to endure such incredible personal people dying around them, long histories of people in the monarchy succumbing to diseases that should have been, you know, wrested away from death, but were not.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's also part of the whole idea of how an individual was, what they were thinking, how they were feeling as a larger current of history affected them, yeah?
Yes. You can't deny that the personal would affect everything, as we do in our lives, right? But sometimes we think that, oh, these people were so powerful and have such a great stature in life. We forget that some of those echoes of the hardships of loving someone as a child who has passed away or a dear spouse has passed away, how that affects you as a leader. Liliu says that she was so overcome by the death of her brother and then the death of her husband that she didn't know what was going on around her at that time.
Well, Jackie, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. I appreciate letting everyone know that our history is coming to life.
That it is.
Yes.
Jackie Pualani Johnson is the author of Nau Wahine Ali'i, A Visit with Emma and Liliuokalani. Two short plays that will be performed Saturday at the Church of the Pacific, Sunday in St. Michael and All Angels Church Hall, both in Lihue, Kauai.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
In HPR's Atherton Studio, the Eli Duo explores a range of musical styles from jazz to Hawaiian, tangos to sonatas. Don't miss Dwayne Padilla on violin, Ian O'Sullivan on guitar, and their excellent eclectic musical adventure on February 13th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
To bring us back to the start of the hour when we were talking about driving drowsy, being tantamount to driving drunk, but beyond that, the whole idea of sleep and how little time we give something that's so essential.
Yes, and how we're always trying to sort of fight it. And you know, you go to any counter and you'll see all these things right by the cash register that will supposedly beat sleep no matter how tired you are. And that ignores how the mind and body work, really.
And it's doing a disservice to our kids and to ourselves. We are such a sleep-deprived nation. And we talk about wanting to work well and to be, you know, so there all the time. And sometimes the place you need to be is in your bed, fast asleep. Maybe we'll give that a little bit more thought as we move through the rest of this day. We're going to come back with you tomorrow. And on the agenda, a wrongfully convicted Ohio man freed last year through the efforts of the Innocence Project. Ricky Jackson is in town to talk about the innocent who are incarcerated in Hawaii.
And jazz vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater has been at the top of the heap for decades. She's in town for a rare club appearance. As to us, you can call us on our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Email for us is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can be posted on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Twitter is HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of that or any of the show, you can find lots of good stuff on HPR2.org. Just look under The Conversation.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation. See you then.